Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
We light this chalice. Now please take a deep breath. As we move into our time together, try to shed the noise and the busyness of life. Breathe deeply and be here now in this place. Nowhere to go, nothing to do, but to be present to yourself and to your community. Breathe and listen. So our little corner of the world has gone cold in the last couple days, but here we can find warmth. Here in this special place during this hour of special time, we find ways to convey to each other our love, to lift up our care for the wider world, to dig deep into the heart of what matters most. Earlier this week, I was with a colleague and she was describing her trip last summer to Transylvania. For those of you who don't know, there is a large Unitarian population in Transylvania. The community has been there for over 400 years, and I learned from this colleague that there, you're born a Unitarian and you die a Unitarian. Unless maybe if you marry out or you've married in. But the Unitarianism there, as she was describing it, is much more European, much more sort of old school, if you will. And it made me think about the realities of our Unitarian Universalism. We are a religion of choice. None of you have to be here. There are probably scores of other things you could have been doing this morning. Instead, you've chosen to be here, and I can't even threaten you with hellfire and brimstone. Your families won't disown you for choosing not to be here. Your presence in this community, your presence here on Sunday mornings is a choice that you are making. A choice I'm grateful for and the whole community is grateful for, because you, by your presence, by choosing this, make this place what it is. Here in this gathering among these people, you have chosen to give your time, your attention, to be part of something, building something lasting. You've chosen to contribute yourself to the creation of something larger than yourself, the hope of which is nothing less than the transformation of the entire world. This morning, as we gather, I offer gratitude for your choice. Each and every one of you make this community better, more whole. Each and every one of you, with all of your differences and joys and struggles and hopes and fears, you create this living, breathing, loving community. Thank you for being with us this morning. May you find here the space to dig deep and know yourself, the time to reflect and think about your cares for this world we share. And may you find, too, a welcome that reminds you that you are loved. This morning, as we do every Sunday, we take time to sit together in silence, to lift up the cares of this community, to acknowledge the cares of the world. As we move into this time, I encourage you to use it however best soothes your soul through meditation, reflection, or prayer. This is a time for you to cultivate your center. So please take a deep breath as we come into our time. Try to relax your body in your seat. Get comfortable. Breathe deeply and slowly. Life, while a gift, is not always easy. It asks us to face many challenges. We know that to live our most moral, most true lives, we must keep our eyes open, not only to our own suffering, but to the suffering of those around us. This morning, we think of the family of Saul Goldberg, especially his wife, Barbara. May their hearts find solace in memories of Saul. We think, too, of all those who are impacted by the ongoing government shutdown. May our lawmakers see sense enough to end the suffering soon. We think of those whose lives and futures are at stake as our nation considers its borders. May this country remember the promise it has never quite met and begin to live it. We think of all those around this world facing grief, illness, anger, and fear. May they know comfort and peace. Even as we hold in our hearts those broken and hurting parts, we offer gratitude for all those around this earth who, in ways small and large, work to make life better for others. We offer gratitude for nurses and doctors, for emergency personnel, for healers and comforters, for friends and family, for mentors and teachers. It is our communities of care, people of kindness and love, helpers and creators that make our lives complete. In the silence, cultivate your center. A long time ago now, I had a conversation with my family that I remember quite vividly to this day. I must have been in high school. My brother was home from college, and we were sitting around the dining room table that I sit around now with my own children. I can't remember what sparked the conversation, but I do remember that it was heated, impassioned, probably at times less thoughtful and more reactionary. And the content was choice. My father stood on one side of the argument, and I sort of hesitate to call it that. Perhaps it would be more properly called a debate. And my brother and I held the line on the other side. At stake was, essentially, the paralysis or privilege of choice. With all the fervor of youth that had always had choices, my brother and I were arguing that too many choices could be paralyzing. Like when you stand in the grocery store staring at the cereal aisle because you cannot fathom how you could possibly choose between one of the hundreds of brightly colored boxes staring back. It's hard, we argued at the time, to know what career path to choose, to know where to live, how to spend your life when you have so many choices. Because once you reach out and put that granola with dried strawberries in your cart, you may well be preventing yourself from choosing the chocolatey one down the line. The cereal analogy doesn't hold well, so we'll drop it. But you can see in life that at certain points, certain choices can be somewhat irrevocable. You turn down a scholarship, you can't get it back again the next year. You accept that job offer, you can't then take the one that comes a week later without impacting your life and career. You choose to be with that person. In many cases, you're shutting a door on other options. There is, in our world of abundant choice, we argued, a deep fear about what it means to make decisions that eliminate choices. There's a fear of lost opportunity, a fear of making the wrong choice, a fear of imperfection or failure or the inability to go back again. We were trying to explain this idea that, well, when one door opens, another door, or when one door closes, another one opens, right? We were trying to say that when you open a door and you walk through it, you're closing yourself off from walking through the other doors. And that, we said, felt hard. That felt like inviting potential grief, inviting being wrong. How could we choose, we said, without knowing what would happen, without knowing what was right, without being sure that it would be the perfect choice? For his part, my father, who had not known much choice in his life, was struggling to grasp this downside of privilege. Better, he said, to have that downside than the alternative. He could not understand where we were coming from, and we couldn't understand why he couldn't understand. We were coming at this conversation from totally different places, totally distinct childhoods, different roles, and different responsibilities. My father, while not necessarily having the language back then to call us on the privilege of being paralyzed by choice, was able to say clearly that while we might have that feeling of fear about choice, choice was still better than no choice. My memory is that at the time, my brother and I grumbled that we were not feeling fully heard and understood. But far more important, as the years have gone by, was that point that my father was making. We were lucky to have so many choices that fear of making the wrong one was a feeling we knew. I thought about that conversation as I reread that passage from The Bell Jar. The narrator imagines sitting in the branches of a fig tree, each stretching limb of wood representing a different possible path. At the end, a ripe fig waiting to be plucked. Each beautiful and interesting and different, none clearly more right than the others, all waiting. And there she is, racked by doubt and uncertainty, frightened into inaction, because to pick one is to give up on the others. The end result, of course, is that all the figs shrivel and drop to the ground. The image and my own story speak to lives of choice and privilege. I recognize that. Not all have that privilege of choice. Too many are constrained simply by the need to survive. But for those of us, even those of us whose lives are relatively set in stone at this point, or for those of us who don't confront choices of great magnitude on a daily basis, still we are faced with choices, small ones and large ones, the impact of which is sometimes predictable and sometimes impossible to foresee. What we do when we are faced with choice is an enormous part of who we are and how we are in this world. Are we people that make choices on a whim? Are we people that make choices that are expedient, self-serving, life-giving, dangerous? One of the ultimate choices we can make is to decide how we will choose. Sometime after that conversation, I first encountered the Sanskrit text, the Bhagavad Gita. Has anyone read this? Maybe some. It's a portion of the Mahabharata. The Mahabharata is a Hindu epic that details the story of this particular war and the princes who fought in it. In the telling of the Mahabharata, there are various philosophical and devotional passages. Among them is the 700-verse Bhagavad Gita, likely written around the 2nd century BCE. The verses of the Gita relate a conversation between one of the princes fighting in this epic war, the prince Arjuna, and his charioteer, Krishna, who is an avatar of the god Vishnu. Prince Arjuna is a warrior. That's his identity, his caste, his place in the social system. The scene of their conversation is the battlefield. Arjuna asks Krishna to drive into the middle of the field so he can see the armies on either side. He looks around. He sees on both sides members of his own family. In the 1979 translation of the text by Keyes Bola, it reads, "In that place, Arjuna saw fathers, grandfathers, mentors, uncles, brothers, sons, grandsons, playmates, fathers-in-law, and close friends in both armies. Seeing all these kinsmen in array, the son of Kunti was overwhelmed by emotion and in despair when he said, "I feel paralyzed. My mouth becomes dry. I tremble within. My hair stands on end. The bow slips from my hand. My skin feels hot. I cannot keep steady. My mind whirls. I see but evil signs. I see nothing good resulting. These men here drawn up in battle, giving their lives and possessions, are the ones for whose sake we desired kingship, pleasure, happiness." This sets off an ethical dilemma about which Arjuna and Krishna speak for the subsequent verses of the piece. Arjuna wants to know if it is moral to kill, given that among the highest virtues in Hinduism is nonviolence, ahimsa. He asks Krishna if he should stay and fight or condemn the war, denying his warrior identity and leaving the battlefield before the fighting begins. He knows that his warrior identity demands that he fight, but he also knows that killing is wrong. His sorrow is so great that he can't decide which to follow. He sits down on his seat in his chariot, his weapons at his feet. He's faced with this impossible choice, and he fears making the wrong one. He fears failing. He fears the implications of choosing the wrong fig. In Hinduism, the term dharma means duty. It means the set of responsibilities that come with our identity, our work, our place in the world. So Arjuna is faced with these competing dharmas: the duty to fight as a warrior, and the duty as a brother, a son, a fellow human being, not to kill. Arjuna has choices. Both have positive and negative implications in the social system he lived in, and they are mutually exclusive. He can't both fight and not fight. He faces a quintessential moral dilemma. Krishna offers advice that begins first with the affirmation that to not choose is also a choice, right? Choice paralysis, inaction in the face of a difficult decision, these are actually still a choice. It's important to remember, of course, that Krishna's advice comes wholly and entirely within a Hindu context of the epic world. Krishna first responds by essentially telling Arjuna that he has misunderstood existence, and if he understood it, he wouldn't be so sorrow-filled. Krishna explains that rebirth and the nature of the soul mean that the deaths of these people don't really matter. So Krishna tells Arjuna to fight. That is his advice in the end. Fight because the war is just. That's one argument he uses. And he uses that term repeatedly. It's a just war. It's okay to fight. But also fight because reincarnation and Krishna's true identity as Vishnu, the maker and destroyer, time and being, means that their death isn't really real in the way that Arjuna understands it. In the cosmology of Hinduism, Krishna points out, quote, "I am time who destroys man's world. Even without you, all these warriors drawn up for battle in opposing ranks would cease to exist." In the time and place of this story, in this religious world, Arjuna's dharma as a warrior takes precedence over any other, and the Lord tells him to fight. I want to just note here for a second that the Bhagavad Gita was also extremely important in the life of Mahatma Gandhi, who understood that war as a metaphorical one between the forces of good and ill. So Krishna's encouragement to fight need not actually be taken as an endorsement of death and destruction, right? Rather, we can understand his encouragement to fight as making a larger point about how we choose, what we choose to privilege when we determine which dharma to follow. So even as Krishna is convincing Arjuna to fight, he's also teaching Arjuna about the best ways to venerate the holy and how best to live a righteous life. There are many options laid out in this text. It doesn't give one perfect way. At one point, Krishna lifts up the danger of false prophets. He says, "Undiscerning men, theologians preoccupied with scriptural lore who claim there is nothing else, their words promise better births through cultic acts, dwell at length on various rites, and aim at pleasure and power. These men are full of desire, zealous for heaven.
They cling to pleasure and power and are fooled by their own discourses. They have no knowledge consisting in commitment, fixed in concentration. The scriptures speak to the world's weave of integrity, passion, and sloth. Transcend it, Arjuna, forever in integrity, detached from things, in command of yourself. Krishna promotes meditation and discipline and figuring out and staying true to some sense of who you are, while also being aware that your very being in space is transient. Later, he tells Arjuna, to be wise, you should be modest, sincere, gentle, forbearing, just. Turn away from what the senses tell you. Stop seeing yourself in the center. And ultimately, Krishna explains to Arjuna that each person has their role to play, and that it is in playing that role that they reach their highest life. He says, if a man is engaged in his proper work, he attains the highest end. One's own duty in its imperfection is better than someone else's duty well performed. Man should not give up work natural to him, even though it is imperfect. Imperfection mars all undertakings, as smoke beclouds the fire. No human pursuit is perfect, Krishna reminds Arjuna. Imperfection mars all undertakings. It's not a reason to give up. The call to pursue one's duty is a call beyond the divide of perfect and imperfect. Now, in the Hindu context of this work, one's duty isn't chosen. The system at work in this text places people into certain social strata, certain roles and responsibilities because of the family they are born into. There's a clarity and simplicity to the system, though of course it is one that oppresses and denies full humanity to all people. It's a system that doesn't actually allow choice very much. We live in quite a different system, most of us. While there are some ways that our lives here in northern New Jersey are constrained, many, if not all of us here, live with an abundance of choice. We can acknowledge that others, not even that far from us, live with far less choice. Now, every choice that we make is not going to be particularly significant. I don't actually think your choice of cereal is going to have some extreme ramifications. But many of our choices do have farther-reaching implications. Will I push it and run through that red light? Will I cut this corner while doing my job? Where am I going to live? Will I drive or will I walk? How will I use my money? To what will I devote my time? Will I be impatient or patient in this moment? Will I take this or give that or speak this way or share that information or offer kindness or refuse compassion? Some of our choices may even feel like impossible ones. Will I radically change my lifestyle because I know that doing so would be better for the planet? Will I quit my job because it asks me to do things that don't actually connect with the ideals I hold dear? Will I cut ties with that friend or family member because their values fundamentally clash with my own? When we consider our lives, this world of relative privilege and choice that we live in, we might do well to consider the advice that Krishna gives, that to, however imperfectly, live one's duty is the highest calling. Remember that clause, however imperfectly. We can understand here in our culture duty not as something that is imposed on us, but something we choose to take on. We might say that the duty of this congregation is the fulfillment of its mission. That's why articulation of mission becomes so important. Our duty as individuals, we might say, is to live our highest ideals of justice and compassion and love, regardless of what the senses tell us, regardless of the siren song of pleasure and privilege. That requires figuring out what our highest ideals actually are. Our duty, we might say, is to face each choice with careful thought and consideration, aware that our choices have consequences. How will we do this? Will we do this? Or will we give in to fear that leads us to choose inaction? Will we answer the calls of our spirit and our highest ideals, however imperfectly? That's the question that Jan Richardson asks in her poem, The Blessing of the Burning Bush. She's referring, of course, to that scriptural moment when God speaks to Moses through a burning bush. She asks how we would respond to such a call from God, from our own deepest values. How would we respond? Would we answer a call that asks us to give up pleasures and privilege and devote ourselves to something wholly new and strange? Something we may not be able to accomplish perfectly, something we might fail at? Would we dig deep enough into ourselves to make radical changes that take us down a path we never thought we might tread? What compromises might we make in order to refuse that call? What sacrifices might we make in order to accept it? Because although my father was right, and I can see that so much more clearly in retrospect, my brother and I were also kind of right. Every time we make a choice, especially the hard ones, something is lost. Arjuna, with Krishna's guidance, made a near impossible choice, and in his case, the result was the death of beloved friends and family, an unbelievably high price. Even as Arjuna makes that choice, confident in the advice of his charioteer, we must imagine that something in him also changes irreparably because of what his dharma calls him to do. The changes to his own being are yet another price. Despite Krishna's godly conviction, in our humanity, we know that almost no choice would be perfect. We know that very rarely are the important choices in our own lives totally clear, perfect in their spiraling effects. Every choice, even the ones we know deep in our bones are right, has a cost. Every choice has consequences known and unknown. Every choice is a risk, some more than others. And every choice and how we make it helps determine who we will become. I don't have a lot of answers this morning, just a lot of questions. When your battlefield moment comes, when your burning bush moment comes, will you be struck by fear and moved to inaction? How will you choose? Will you risk imperfection and the unknown because it means becoming ever more who you are truly meant to be when you live by your deepest values and highest ideals? Will you, as Richardson writes, know your path not by how it shines before you, but by how it burns within you, leaving you whole as you go from here blazing with your inarticulate, your inescapable yes? When the call comes, my hope for you, for me, for all of us, is that we are ready to answer, however imperfectly, in spite of our fears, so that we can live our fullest and truest lives. So may it be. Please join in the words for extinguishing the chalice there in your order of service. We extinguish this flame, but not May your life be filled with options, and may you never let fear keep you from action. Rather, may you face your choices, embracing the shining light inside you with your community as your charioteer. Go in peace.